The Tom Woods Show, episode 1091.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, in 2018, more people than ever are going to be starting up a side hustle online. I know how to do this, and I'll show you step by step exactly what I do in my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income. Grab it over at pathstoincome.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. This is a really, really fun, great, and I hope informative conversation with Dave Smith, who is the libertarian podcaster. This is my appearance recently on his podcast, Part of the Problem. He's also a comedian and an outstanding one. I highly recommend, although bear in mind it is an adult comedy special, but I highly recommend his special Libertas, which you can grab at tomwoods.com/Libertas. That's not an affiliate link or anything, but it's just a lot easier to say than the longer URL where you can find it. So tomwoods.com/Libertas is a shortcut to get over there. Well, Dave and I talk about a whole bunch of things in this really, really great conversation. I just love spending time with Dave, whether on his podcast or in person. He's just a great guy. He very much underrates his skill and knowledge when it comes to libertarianism. He knows a lot more and gets it a lot better than some PhDs I know. He's really, really great, really impressive. I enjoy listening to his podcast, Part of the Problem, and I hope you'll check it out as well. Links at tomwoods.com/1091, and here we go.
Tom Woods, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. So glad to be here.
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm thrilled to have you. For people who don't know Tom Woods, number one, get your life together and figure out who he is. He is the author of 12, I believe, fantastic books, including most recently, Real Dissent, which was unbelievable, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization. There's a provocative title for you. And some other great ones as well. Of course, he is the host of The Tom Woods Show. And let me tell you this. If you listen to this podcast, I'm going to be angry at you if you don't go join Tom's email list immediately. It's the best thing in the world. It's like my favorite newsletter out there. Go to tomwoods.com and sign up right now. Tom, anything else that you want to plug?
Well, let's do tomsfreebooks.com because I'll give you a free book while you're at it.
Oh, that's right. In addition to these 12 books that Tom's written, he's constantly putting out ebooks and giving them away for free. There are a bunch of great ones up there.
I got one that smashes Bernie Sanders. I got one called, and I'm proud of this title. Dave, I'm proud of that. I mean, I'm not a professional comedian, but occasionally I get a good one. I like just the cleverness of the title, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. Because, man, when that healthcare debate came up, oh my gosh, all your Facebook friends from high school are so wrong and ridiculous, and they're lecturing you. So I thought Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare was a good title. And could you believe nobody had purchased the domain name yourfriendsarewrong.com? I took it.
That's unbelievable. And by the way, it was fantastic. Although I will say Bernie Sanders is wrong is just a pretty great title and cuts right
to
the point.
Yeah.
And it really is that one particularly, if anyone's interested in like debating any of these democratic socialists that are running around, it really goes point by point through just the ridiculous nature of their argument.
And so that's all over at tomsfreebooks.com. Pick one, pick them all, whatever you want to do, but they're sitting there waiting for you.
Okay, excellent. I highly, highly recommend that stuff. So you are now, you've done, in addition to all this writing, you've done well over 1,000 podcasts at this point. How do you, let me ask you this, because it seems to me like every topic under the sun has been covered, but you keep coming up with new stuff. How do you figure out what to do next?
Well, in a way, I could ask you that because you produce not as many episodes, but in terms of the amount of time in each episode, I think we're producing roughly the same amount of content every week. And what bails the two of us out is current events.
Yeah,
because
sure
I know, even though I may have hit everything I could possibly hit, tomorrow's a new day. Something else always going on. But on the other hand, history is just so darn long. Right? There are so many figures and thinkers you could talk about, time periods you could talk about, ideas you could talk about. So maybe I'll get to a point where I've exhausted it all. But then at that point, everybody will have forgotten the first 1,000 episodes and I can go back and re-examine some of those topics. So it just never ends. And of course, until the state is gone, again, there's plenty of insanity going on around you all the time to comment on. I mean, they're handing me topics.
Yeah, isn't it ironic that when we finally get the anarcho-capitalist world we want to live in, all of us are going to be out of a job?
Yeah, I'll be pumping gas because there won't be a minimum wage anymore to destroy that job, so I'll be out doing that.
How many books can you write about how everything's going great?
Yeah, I know it. I mean, no one buys that.
Yeah, it's not selling the same way as taking down the establishment is. So you've been in the libertarian world for a while now. I really wonder about this, and I was curious to get your take on it, because really, I almost struggle sometimes with the idea of just the word itself, libertarian, and how successful we've been at kind of branding ourselves or using that word. I remember Hans Hermann Hoppe gave a speech last year in which he said that the word libertarian is in danger of going the way that the word liberal went, because it's expanded so much that it almost means nothing. And then I look at, you know, some of the left libertarians that are out there who sometimes don't even seem to resemble true libertarianism to me. I look at the Libertarian Party, which is just, I mean, me and you have both had our problems with them for a while. Do you think when people hear the word libertarian now that it kind of has this bad association? Like they just think of Gary Johnson asking you to bake Nazi cakes and not knowing a foreign country?
I didn't think so up until relatively recently. For example, I was recently on the Andrew Klavan show over on thedailywire.com. I think that's Ben Shapiro's outfit. We may get back to him at some point.
Oh, we will.
Yeah. But I was on this podcast with this was perfectly nice guy. And he said, all right, now, so you're a libertarian. He said, now, does that mean just, and then he just went through the usual things, that you want to smoke pot and that it really just boils down to mundane things like that. And I said, well, look, first of all, you're talking to the squariest of the squares here. Like I've never actually smoked pot, which is probably, I think I may be the only person I know who can say, well, one of the only people I know who can say that. So I my view is if people are doing that, or even if they're using harder drugs that may even do them some real damage, the question is, what's the best way to approach that? And I don't think, I mean, let's be blunt about it. What's going to happen if you put these people in prison? Prison rape is not the best solution to their problem. There has to be a solution better than that. So what I explained to him is that libertarianism has nothing to do with preferences for I'd like to smoke this or I'd like to do that. It has to do with property and the right to exchange and own and defend your property. So the war on drugs is a violation of the right of property. That's why we're against it. And then, of course, it has a lot of subsidiary damages that it does, but it's primarily because it violates property rights, which is a form of aggression, and we're against aggression. So our argument, I explained, is just simply that we don't favor initiating aggression. And I said, now, a lot of people think I said, look, our whole principle just boils down to don't initiate aggression. Just keep your hands to yourself. And he came back with, doesn't everybody believe that? And I said, they say they do, but when push comes to shove and they see where we're taking it, they're not necessarily willing to follow us along on that path. And he said, well, where are you taking it? Well, where would this go that people might not approve of it? And I said, all right, well, let's abolish all the antitrust laws. Now where's everybody on non-aggression? Let's abolish the minimum wage. Now where's everybody? See, I'm losing people all the time just talking to you here. Yeah. But he started off basically thinking that libertarianism was kind of this milquetoast, I want to smoke some pot and maybe lower my taxes, but I really want to smoke the pot. That really is the top thing. And I tried to explain that. It actually is a whole way of thinking, and it's a way of thinking that generates amazing results. And once you understand the idea of liberty, you never look at the world the same way again. You get to the heart of so much of what's wrong with society, why the economy goes in the tank every once in a while. You begin to understand that because you understand the Fed. The Fed is also engaged in forms of aggression indirectly because it's a coercive monopoly and so on. There's so many ways you see the world differently, or you look at war differently and foreign policy differently. You don't think of it as us versus them. You just think it as them versus them.
Yeah. It seems to me one of the things that really initially like really attracted me to kind of Rothbardian, Mises Institute, libertarianism, just to distinguish it, because a lot of the things that you're saying, the misconceptions about libertarians do actually kind of apply to the Libertarian Party. I mean, those aren't guys who really, I mean, Gary Johnson wants the government to force you to bake a Nazi cake, and he's not for freedom of association. He wasn't even for legalization of other drugs. It did kind of seem like a guy who just wants to smoke pot. But one of the things that really attracted me to Rothbardian libertarianism and to Austrian economics was it just seemed like that was the only group who really cared about being intellectually consistent. And that there were all these other groups out there. I mean, like the mainstream conservatives or the neocons or whoever, they'll sit around and preach about small government, but yet they're always saying we're not funding the military enough. And you know, they'll talk about freedom. Like if Obamacare comes in, this is a big violation of freedom. But then they'll be like, oh, you know, if someone asks for a lawyer, you tell them you don't get a lawyer. Is there anybody else who's ever kind of been as obsessed with intellectual consistency as the Rothbardians?
Right. And there's something great about that because it means that you really are adhering to principle. Whereas when you're one of these milquetoast libertarians where, yeah, I want freedom, but hold on a minute, we can't have that. I don't want to ruin people's lives in the drug war, but come on now, we got to criminalize that drug. Well, then it just starts looking like you don't really have a philosophy. You just have a loose set of personal preferences that you want to impose on everybody. Whereas with you and me, it's this is my principle, and I'm going to apply it across the board. And it has nothing to do with favoritism toward a drug or toward a person or toward a group of people. It's a consistent principle across the board. So say what you will about the principle, but I'm not just arbitrarily barking out ideas according to my own whims the way some of these people sound like they're doing.
Yeah, no, look, I think you absolutely nailed it right there. And this is, you know what, this will lead into, as you alluded to earlier, that I did want to bring up a clip of Ben Shapiro that was brought to my attention in my, I have a private Facebook group because my life is spent copying everything that you do, Tom Woods. And this clip was posted recently, and it kind of speaks to what we're talking about here with, you know, inconsistencies in people's moral and political views. And so one of the first things, let me just give a little background for this. So for people who know, because I've told my story many times on the podcast, but I was first brought into this libertarian world by Ron Paul. It was the Giuliani moment, as it's called, although I have renamed that the Ron Paul moment because it was really not about Rudy Giuliani at all. That could have been anyone on that stage. It just happened to be him. But that moment sparked my interest, and then I was researching everything I could get my hands on to learn more about Ron Paul, and I found Peter Schiff first, and then I found you. And Tom was really the guy who convinced me on this philosophy. So just giving that background. And one of the things that, Tom, you used to do during the Ron Paul days, which was like my favorite thing ever, is you would make these videos smacking down the anti-Paulians of the world and the people who were critiquing Ron Paul, and you would do them in this kind of succinct, just devastating fashion. And so as I have you on the show and someone brought this clip to my attention, I thought, how much fun would it be to do one of them right here on Part of the Problem?
And just so you know, I have not heard this clip. I haven't seen it, so I don't know what's going to hit me here.
Okay. All right. So you're going in fresh. I have seen the clip, full disclosure. So this was Ben Shapiro goes around speaking at a lot of different colleges, and he usually will give a little bit of a speech and then take a question and answer segment. I will preface this by saying Ben Shapiro is a guy that I have a lot of respect for. I think I'd probably agree with large areas of his views, and he does a phenomenally good job at smacking down campus leftist nonsense, which, you know, Tom it does a great job at that as well. But here are the parts. See if you can notice the inconsistencies. So here's Ben Shapiro taking a question from a student.
Hello, Ben. My name is Joe. I'm holding my phone because I'm recording for my dad. He's a big fan, so he says hi.
That's how I say hi.
Yeah.
Hey, Dad. How's it going?
So I have two pretty serious points to address. In 2016, you had put out a list of people that you thought were characterized as the alt-right. And one of them happened to be a philosopher who I hold pretty highly, Ron Paul. And I was kind of curious why you put Ron Paul on that list. just because Ron Paul was one of the people that did inspire me to conservatism.
Right. So Ron Paul's libertarian views on government, I'm largely in agreement with, and that's not what makes him alt-right on that list. What made him alt-right on that list was a sense of identity politics that amounted to him engaging in relatively open anti-Semitism, unfortunately. Ron Paul wrote for an anti-Semitic newsletter in Texas. He wrote a book in which he equated anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and then basically said that he was anti-Zionist. He's been involved with soft-peddling members of the alt-right for a long time. I think that the idea of him as a pure alt-right figure might be a bit of an exaggeration. Maybe you want to say that he is friendly to the alt-right. Really? At least a lot on the alt-right are friendly to him. But the relationship in terms of foreign policy, I would say he's a paleocon who verges on alt-right. Not everybody who's paleo, maybe you're right. Maybe the idea is that he's not fully alt-right because he doesn't espouse a white supremacist view that says that white people are superior to other people. But he is fully in line with an anti-Semitic view that views Israel as the font of all evil in the Western world. And he has given aid and comfort to a lot of folks on the alt-right. So I think that's probably a fair criticism.
Okay. All right, Tom. So you heard the question. First off, let me just say that it did kind of warm my heart that a college student stood up and said, here's a philosopher who I hold in high regard, who you put on this alt-right list. So I did like that. But what's your response to Ben Shapiro?
Well, it's interesting that Shapiro more or less concedes that probably the kid has a fair point.
Yeah.
Which is more than most people would say. They would just double down. But he says that Ron Paul supports identity politics. And I thought, the same Ron Paul, you sure? The same grandfatherly guy we saw who just constantly avoided that sort of thing all the time? The same guy who, before every group he was invited to, he just talked about individual rights? You've probably heard me say this before, but he was invited to an Arab American dinner. Mm-hmm. And they said, Dr. Paul, have you written a special speech for our group? And he says, no, it's the same speech I give everywhere. That's the exact opposite of identity politics, right? Yeah. The exact opposite. I give the same speech to every group. I don't care what your identity is. Then it was open anti-Semitism. Well, open? Well, open anti-Semitism? Like, what was he saying? Jews are terrible people? I mean, did you ever hear Ron Paul say something like that? That would be open anti-Semitism. So then it turned out he wrote for an anti-Semitic newsletter. Now, look, I've heard this one sort of thing a million times. Yeah. First of all, did they just reprint an article of his, a speech or something? I don't know. Let me look at highly, highly unlikely. I basically don't believe that. But he's upset that Ron Paul made a distinction between anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist, that you can be anti-Zionist without being anti-Semitic. Well, obviously you can. Zionism just has to do with should the Jewish people have a national home in Palestine, because that's what Zionism eventually became. And initially, Zionism was not committed necessarily to Palestine as the home for the Jewish people, but eventually that's what it became. And early on, like if you look at the late 19th century, the most ferocious opponents of Zionism were religiously observant Jews, because they viewed it as hubris, that God would miraculously restore the Jewish people at a time of his choosing. It's not like God is waiting for human effort, like, you know, let's get off our rear ends and give God a little push here. That was viewed as not how history was supposed to go. So there were plenty of anti-Zionist Jews right around the time Zionism was being started. So that whole thing. And then he says, well, maybe he's not friendly to the alt-right, but the alt-right is friendly to him. Well, again, what does that mean? So I'm responsible for the views of people who happen to like what I have to say. John Wayne Gacy voted for Jimmy Carter. I don't blame Carter for that. And likewise, I bet there are people who like Ben Shapiro, who he probably would not want to invite to his home for dinner. I bet there are a lot of boorish people who have very, very unfashionable views who happen to like Ben Shapiro. But I wouldn't say that's the reason we shun Ben Shapiro. I would say smearing people like this would be a much more a much better reason. And then being critical of Israel. I mean, obviously, the idea that Ron Paul thinks Israel is the font of all evil in the world is absurd. I mean, I'm sure he thinks the U.S. government is the font of all evil if he had to pick one.
Oh, I mean, his view. Yes, he spent far more time talking about the chaos that the U.S. government has created in the Middle East than he ever did about Israel, probably because he's an American who was an American congressman who was running for president of the United States of America. But, you know, one of the things that really stuck out to me about this that I just find kind of hilarious is that they go, first of all, so he starts by saying that Ron Paul engaged in identity politics, which, as you point out right away, I mean, that just could not be further from what Ron Paul ever talked about. And then he says he engaged in identity politics for being anti-Zionist. Zionism is the definition of identity politics. What could be more identity politics than Zionism? I mean, good like, point. He also, by the way, you know, he says there, if you actually catch the exactly what Ben Shapiro says he had a book where he wrote about Zionism. Now, I really do wonder if Ben Shapiro's read the book. The book he's referring is Liberty Defined. And he says, Ron Paul equated anti-Semitism with anti-Zionist and then said he's anti-Zionist. Well, close, except 180 degrees wrong. What he actually did was say it's unfair to equate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism and then criticized Zionism. So he went out of his way to make the opposite point. And yes, of course, the idea that if you're critical of Israel, well, I mean, let's turn this around on Ben Shapiro a little bit. So Ben Shapiro is very critical of college campuses. Ben Shapiro is against education. Evidently, right? I mean, you can't be critical of something now without what, like hating all of the people involved in it. It really is one of it drives me crazy because it's everything that Ben Shapiro spends his entire career blasting, he instantly becomes when Ron Paul or anti-war libertarians are brought up. It's like, oh, actually, you're engaging in identity politics. You're slamming someone as essentially being a bigot just because they're critical of certain policies. Like, okay, he's critical of Israel's foreign policy. So am I, and I'm a Jew whose whole family is Jewish. Like, what is that? You know, this is absurd.
And of course, it's not like he just randomly chooses Israel, or as Shapiro would say, he chooses Israel because it's full of Jewish people and he hates them, so that's why he's critical. There's something about the relationship between Israel and the United States that does not exist between a lot of other countries. Like, we don't have the United States Senate voting 99-1 or 100-0 in favor of resolutions favoring particular countries that everybody else in the world is voting 100-0 against. There is nothing that compares with the American relationship with Israel. And the point is that in having that relationship, the United States risks alienating public opinion in a lot of countries in the Middle East. Now, people will say, oh, those countries aren't going to like you anyway. But that's actually not true. And we can prove that in the years after World War I, if you were to go to Syria, as the King Crane Commission did, and say, which country would you like to govern you as a League of Nations mandate? They overwhelmingly said the United States. The United States had an excellent reputation in the Middle East through the first half of the 20th century, and then the relationship with Israel came up. Now, it could well be that the relationship with Israel is so self-evidently, obviously good that it trumps all the negative consequences. But the point is, there obviously are negative consequences. There's no other country we have that kind of relationship with. So why wouldn't you pay particular attention to that relationship and see if, on balance, it's a good thing or a bad thing for the United States? There's nothing obvious about that. It's not self-evident. You don't come out of the womb knowing that the relationship with Israel is a net plus. You have to examine it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And it's a really good point that you bring up with Syria being looking at the United States so favorably. It turns out that in the Middle East at that time, they really liked America and they really hated the English and the French. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Shocking. Sure. You know, who could put that puzzle together?
Then you start acting like the English and the French and they don't like you anymore. How about that?
Yeah, it's almost like when you slaughter people's families, they tend to hate you.
Yeah, so there you go.
It's just so infuriating because this is a guy who all he deals with all day long is people calling him a Nazi because he'll say, like, you know, whatever, like he's against welfare. So now they say he's a racist and he just engages in the exact same thing. He falls right to their level once, you know, he's challenged. And yes, I do acknowledge what you said. You can clearly see, which is very rare, but you see Ben Shapiro backpedaling a little bit and saying, like, well, maybe he's not like you know, completely open about his anti-Semitism. Look, man, Ron Paul, so I'll just share a story just briefly. So when I met Ron Paul and I was on the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and so me and Ron Paul and Daniel McAdams, we talked in his office for about a half hour. Then we went out and we filmed the episode. And then we came back and we spoke in his office for like another hour. And I had mentioned something during the show about my grandfather escaping Germany during the Second World War. And he asked me more about that. And, you know, I gave a little bit of my family history, that they were Austrian Jews who then moved to Berlin, and that my grandfather got out in 38. And he said, he asked me, he said, did anyone else, you know, who else in your family got out? And I said, my grandfather was the only one. The rest of them all died. A few of them died in death camps, and a few of them just died in the war. And Ron Paul, I'll never forget this moment. It's such a sincere moment. Ron Paul just put his head down in his hand, sitting at his desk, and he goes, "What a tragedy. What a tragedy." And then he started talking about how Mises was run out of the country and how his work was destroyed and how awful World War II was. I mean, the idea that this guy has a hateful bone in his body, you are so off your freaking rocker. You're just, it's like every time someone has to criticize the Mises Institute, or they criticize you or Ron Paul, it can never just be like, well, here's what I think they get wrong. This is why I don't think anarcho-capitalism is the way to go. Or this is where I think that they, you know, made a false argument. It's always like, muhuhahaha. I know they've never said anything about this, but I'm telling you, somewhere under the surface is a real hateful person.
And it's so stupid. It's always something like, yeah, and he was in the bathroom, and at the stall next to him was some guy who asked him a question. It's stupid. Well, show me something I've done. I mean, just give me. But, you know, and there was a time in my life where I used to chase after these people and say, hey, I'm not such and such that you're accusing me of. But, you know, at some point, you got to just reclaim your dignity and say, look, anybody who's seeking the truth will immediately, as soon as they see your persona and they listen to you a little bit, they immediately know this is the typical made up hysteria that we see 24 hours a day. They'll just know it. And if they don't see that, then I just don't care. I mean, I'm not going to try to persuade somebody like that. There's so many regular, normal, rational people that I can go after. I want to go after the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, no, look, I agree with you on that. And it's just, it's completely unfair and just so beneath a guy who is as smart as Ben Shapiro to say, which essentially is what his position is that we can talk about all these issues. We can talk about the most provocative, the most, you know, like inflammatory issues. And God bless him for all that. I admire the fact that he's got the stones to go in and say, hey, you know what? Instead of just bitching about systematic racism, how about this? How about don't have kids out of wedlock, don't do drugs, and graduate high school? And then there's like an 80% chance you won't end up in poverty. How about that? I can say this harsh truth, which is wildly politically incorrect, to say, okay, I'm all for that. However, we're not allowed to criticize the wars or the Fed, because then, of course, you're an anti-Semite.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, was it? Now, it might not have been Shapiro, but somebody kind of like him was explaining why he didn't take on the Fed. And his answer was, well, a lot of people who are anti-Semitic are critical of the Fed. What a right. dumb thing to say. What a ridiculous thing to say. You look at the evidence and the arguments, and you look at it on the merits. And half the time, those people who are critical of the Fed are critical of it for dumb reasons. They're critical of it for the dumb guy reasons. And I don't really want to insult people, but for example, these are the ones who say that the problem with the Fed is that it's owned by blah, blah, blah. It's a private right. bank. Like the problem with the Fed is it's not socialistic enough. That's the problem with it for you. And that, or the Fed is stingily refusing to pump enough money into the economy. Some of those people say, so in general, the anti-Semites, of whom there are indeed some who are critical of the Fed, turns out, you know, they can't help themselves but get that wrong too.
Right. And of course, it's not even anything resembling an argument to say that, well, because some bad people criticize this, we can't criticize it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of communists who said slavery was wrong. Well, guess what? They're right on that one. You know, I mean, okay. Yeah, so
the commies didn't like the Nazis either. Right. Well, we're also allowed to not like the Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's like, okay, so you're going to sit here and say you're all about individual liberty and small government, yet we can't criticize the two things that enable big government more than anything else. More than anything else.
Yeah. You know, you can get rid of the USDA all you want. You know, you can go after public housing and try and get the increase in the budget limited to just 3% a year or something, if that floats your boat. But you're not going after the heart of the monster you're supposedly opposing if you're leaving those twin pillars standing. You're not even trying to take a swing at them.
Right, and these are people who consider themselves constitutionalists, and there's no constitutional authority to have a Federal Reserve, and there's absolutely, like, you don't need to be a constitutional scholar, like a sixth grader who reads the Constitution can know that Congress has not declared these wars, that drone bombing American citizens is illegal. I mean, like, you know, like, come on.
Yeah, I know it. The constitutionalists sometimes, some of them are decent folks, but sometimes they're the worst because the Constitution does authorize, well, first of all, it does authorize, obviously, the military. So then sometimes they'll feel like, well, then I've got nothing to say. It's in there. But some of the smarter and more principled ones will at least say, if we're going to go to war, it ought to be declared, which is something. And that's at least something. There's some assertion of some kind of power on the part of the Congress. But ultimately, as I get older, Dave, I'm just kind of losing patience with the whole constitutional argument. I mean, if that's what gets people to come over to our side and see things the way we see it, that's fine. But in general, I don't really want to have to fall back on the Constitution. It's just wrong. These policies are stupid, and they enrich the worst kind of people in the world, and they impoverish everybody else. And the military stuff is a disaster based on propaganda and lies that is carried out by profiteers. I don't care about the Constitution on that. Maybe it backs me up, but who cares? This is dumb and self-defeating and evil, and so I'm against it for those reasons.
Yeah, no, look, I completely agree with you. I mean, I've heard you make this point before on your show as well, but the constitutional argument is only useful to me at this point in the sense that pointing out that all these guys do violate their own document and that they all do swear to uphold it, and they're clearly all, you know, not living up to that oath.
Right. And sometimes the thing that makes that light bulb go off in somebody's mind is when you point out, here's your document, and now look at the results. And you say, well, that's because they're not following the document. Yeah, okay. But do you see the problem with resting your hopes on a document? Because yeah, you're right. They won't obey the document. And then what do you do?
Right. And then you're in the situation we're in now.
Right. So might as well just chuck the whole thing and, you know, I mean, let's at least be honest about the situation we face.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of ways, it does seem that the probably the biggest difference between, you know, what is traditionally, not traditionally, but what is currently thought of as conservatives, which is really very close to the neoconservatives, and libertarians like you and myself, really are these issues. I mean, there's a reason why in the Ron Paul campaigns, I mean, there's really no question about it, the two central issues were the wars and the Fed. And it does seem to me like this is, you know, it's just frustrating when they can't even meet us with an argument, because I think these things are getting harder and harder to defend. I mean, look at the results of these wars over the last decade or so. Look at the—I mean, at this point, it's pretty hard to defend the Fed when they've held interest rates at zero for a decade. So it's like, as we're winning the argument, it seems like the slurs get worse and worse.
Yeah, well, there's that, and they really, really want to make it toxic for you to go after these sectors of the government and society. They want it to have a you know, like a danger, no trespassing sign on it. And the way they do that is by demonizing and destroying anybody who touches it. Now, Ron Paul was able to get away with it. They did demonize him, but it kind of bounced off him. I mean, yeah, there are uninformed people who still think Ron Paul is a kook, even though he predicted everything that's come true since then. You know, he's the kook, right. But by and large, those young kids did not care. They just didn't care. What young kid is watching the nightly news, right, to be lectured to about Ron Paul? They don't even hear it. And that's the beauty of it. They didn't even hear this stuff. They just went on supporting him.
Yeah, and I actually think after a while, if anything, and this is certainly the case with like the Trump dynamic, but if anything, it kind of started helping him. because it just started exposing like, oh yeah, these guys are all, they have no argument, but they're all against you. And this kind of, you know,
right. And then you look at him and he's just this kind of like old guy who just stands up there unrehearsed as can be, just keeps uttering unpopular truths, keeps winning all the online polls. And the more you find out about him, the more you like him, about his personal background and stuff. I mean, that is kind of a, you know, frankly, a badass. What else are you going to say?
Yeah,
right?
Really.
And you know, and he's the last person in the world to use language like that. But what else can you say about him?
I mean, it's just so, the whole thing, I mean, I can't, it gets me angry, but as I calm down about it, I just kind of focus on the, like, you know, the absurdity of it all and kind of try to find the funny in it. But it really is, it's like these guys at the Mises Institute all hate Jews. You're like, it's the Mises Institute.
Like, idiot.
What's wrong with you?
The most famous, or to my mind, one of the most famous early photos of Lou Rockwell when he was in the libertarian movement shows him standing around with Bert Blumert, Walter Block, and Murray Rothbard. So that's why the anti-Semites of yore used to call him Jew Rockwell, because he was surrounded by Jews. So it's ridiculous that you would think, you know, anything else about him.
It's like, yeah, and it's like the thing where they go like, you know, Lou Rockwell is a closeted white nationalist. And you're like, well, for a white nationalist, he hangs out with a bunch of Jews and wrote a book on the evils of nationalism.
Yeah,
just doesn't seem like a great white nationalist.
Yeah, either that or it's 5D chess, Dave.
You
know?
Right.
Somehow,
but that's like
eventually,
the thing.
When he lulls us into sleep, then he'll come out and get us.
But and it was like the thing with Jeff Dice last year, where it's like, so are you telling me? Let me try to walk through this 5D chess conspiracy theory that you're at. Are you telling me that the president of the Mises Institute, his game plan here is to dog whistle Nazis and preach non-aggression to them? Why would I be against that?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be like the greatest thing ever?
Right. Of course you want to preach it to them. But then, yeah, the whole dog whistle thing. I mean, I don't even want to talk about this anymore. But the idea that you would be uttering words that maybe the Nazis will hear me say, but no one else will.
Right, right.
Okay, first of all, that alone, just even uttering that should sound so stupid that you should be embarrassed to say it. But if you did happen to go ahead and say it, let me just take it a step further. What somebody at the Mises Institute wants, what you want is donors. You want to get donors. You don't want to compromise to get donors, but you need to keep the lights on. Now, if of all people I wanted to appeal to somebody to help keep the lights on, I would not say to myself, well, you know, the best, most successful people in America, the ones who have the deepest pockets and are prospering, are the Nazis. Because you all know Nazis are at the top of they're the CEOs of every corporation. You can just hear the Nazi propaganda coming out of Starbucks, for example. It's just everywhere. I mean, why would you what would you stand to gain? You stand to gain nothing other than opprobrium and ridicule and smears. And you would gain, what, 17 cents in donations? It doesn't even make sense. Why would you think? So, yeah, the whole thing's ridiculous. And, of course, that's why I am sure that other than the true dullards in the libertarian movement, and we can't underestimate those numbers, for the most part, these people obviously know perfectly well. Jeff Dice is a regular guy who feels the same way about Nazis as anybody else would. I mean, of course they know. They're not, I mean, come on. I mean, somebody like Tom Palmer, you think he's actually that stupid? I mean, he's not. He does not have a low IQ. He's not, you know, he may not be the brightest bulb, but he does not have a low IQ. He's just doing it out of institutional rivalry and to try to destroy somebody else. Now, it's not to say that I've never been critical of Tom Palmer, but I'm critical of him because he attacks me.
Right.
I don't just out of the blue say, let me just go attack some, you know, Cato has-been. Why would I waste my time? Why would I do that? Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's like, like we were saying before, it's like, okay, so Ron Paul spent a lot of time criticizing the Federal Reserve and the neocons. So do you, so do I. A lot of them happen to be Jewish. I mean, I'm not even, by the way, saying there's nothing there. Like, it does seem like there are a lot of Jews in there. A lot of the commies were Jewish. But as I just pointed out, so are a lot of the people at the Mises Institute who are preaching the exact opposite. So if we're siding with, like, this group that has a lot of Jews in it against this group that has a lot of Jews in it, I guess the logical conclusion would be it's about the ideas.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I don't know if it's Michael Malice or somebody was saying, Jewish person who felt like he could get away with saying this, said something like, when you have a group of people that's highly intelligent, you're going to find lots of them in a lot of places. And that helps to explain a lot, right? I mean, that's why there are a lot of them in capitalism, a lot of them in socialism, there's a lot over here, there's a lot over there. That's how that works.
Yeah. And yet we're not dominating the NBA. Somehow.
As it turns out. But neither are Armenians like me. But right, I've learned to live with this. I'm okay with that. Life's too short.
Sometimes I look back at clips of the NBA in like the 1930s and I'm like, I think I could have made it. But not but not anymore. Not these days. All right. So, you know, while we were talking about the, you know, anti-war stuff and why it's so important, because I know you did come from kind of a traditional conservative background, and you said you were at one point pretty much a neocon. And I always thought this was interesting. I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about it, because you said it was the first war in Iraq that really gave you pause about this. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, because first of all, we were hearing what turned out later to be inflated figures of how many Iraqi soldiers were being killed out there and basically burned alive and stuff. But regardless of how high the figure is, it was still an awful lot of people. And it just seemed to me weird that because they were soldiers, it was okay to cheer for them dying. And I thought, now, if they were soldiers trying to invade my neighborhood, then I probably would cheer them dying. But I didn't have anything against these people. I had no idea what this was really about. I mean, it had nothing to do with democracy in Kuwait, for heaven's sake. I mean, give me some credit. It was a dispute over oil, basically. Saddam was slant drilling, or I beg your pardon, Kuwait was slant drilling on Saddam, and so he decided to do this to them. Now, he obviously shouldn't have invaded the country. I totally get that. But the long and the short of it is, I just looked at the news reports, and I thought, I bet a lot of these people in the Iraqi army are just like a lot of the people in the American army, desperate young kids who feel like this is a way to earn a salary, and they're just desperate kids. And their husbands and fathers, and their deaths mean complete ruin for the families at home. And so I felt like, wait a minute, I'm having a forbidden thought. I'm concerned about the families of soldiers in a country that is not my own. But then I thought, but they're human. Why do I have to basically treat them as not being human, in effect? Like, their deaths don't even matter. So the whole thing was really hitting me all at once really hard back in 1991.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know how to make this right in my mind. And it really kind of settled there uneasily for several more years until I finally came across people who were not on the left, because I was resolutely not on the left, but who were at least as anti-war as those people. There weren't as many then as there are now. But when I found those people, I said, okay, now I'm at home, and now I'm going to say my instinct was correct. This is bad, and I'm against it.
Yeah, it's an interesting—I mean, I was really young when that war was going on. I must have been 8 years old. I was born in 83, so 8 years old when this was happening. And I remember at our age, it had made its way down to children— that Saddam's army was going into Kuwait and taking babies out of incubators. Like, the war propaganda is just insane. Of course, this has been completely disproven.
Yeah, it has. And of course, the woman who was testifying about this before Congress turned out to be the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. You'd think, or it could have been the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.N. I forget which one it was, but she's the daughter of some Kuwaiti ambassador. How does nobody notice that?
Yeah.
That maybe she's got a line she's trying to pull here. She's got an angle on this whole thing. But that baby's being thrown out of the incubators. If you're invading a foreign country, would you say, hold on a minute, everybody, I know we want to march into the Capitol, but we got to take a quick pit stop, get to the hospital, start tossing babies out of incubators? Something seems off about that. That just seems gratuitous to me. I'm not saying that there are never any atrocities committed, but, you know, going after Kuwait's a pretty quick thing. It's a tiny little country. You run right in, you decapitate it, you're done. It would seem like the babies out of incubators is a distraction that's only going to be used against you in the propaganda war.
Yeah, you'd think maybe you'd want to at least ask a few questions rather than taking that just as fact as it seemed to be taken. And you know, I thought so. This was an interesting moment, that first the Persian Gulf War, because, well, obviously hindsight being 2020, I mean, it led to more wars and just catastrophe, and in many ways, it was one of the things that incited the sanctions that were to come and the bombings that were to come, incited Al Qaeda, and of course we've been. It's led to basically two more wars, or one more war, however you want to look at it. One of the longest wars in American history. But this first Persian Gulf War was fairly popular, and it was fairly celebrated. It was celebrated as an overwhelming success. Yet you were in this group, like a small group of principled conservatives who were really affected by this and disillusioned by it. And I think Pat Buchanan was another one who really came to grow to be suspicious of the warfare state.
He was dead set against it from the build up onward. He was completely against it from the beginning, and I couldn't get it. I thought, geez, I used to kind of like this guy when he was on TV and stuff. I used to watch Crossfire on CNN, and he was a great debater and fun to watch, and I couldn't get, Pat, why are you not on board? But that kind of stayed in the back of my mind, like it's okay to be against this, because nobody is going to claim Pat Buchanan ain't on the right. So it's okay to be against this. Then I read Buchanan's autobiography right from the beginning, and he's got a couple of pages where he talks about how inhumane the atomic bombings of Japan were. And again, Buchanan can say that, and it makes it seem like, wait a minute, it's okay. And I think that's, getting back to Ron Paul, the role that he played.
Yeah.
That suddenly it seemed okay. Wait a minute, if you're uneasy about this, that's okay. You should be uneasy with it.
Yeah, I'm as conservative a conservative person as you could be. I'm married to the same woman for over 50 years. I'm a Christian. I'm completely for the free market. Oh, and I also think these wars are completely, wrong. It's like that's a powerful message.
Does he even say the word heck?
Yeah.
You know, so for him to take that position, it really, really opened up opportunities for a lot of people to think in different ways for a change.
Yeah, absolutely. And another one that was pretty interesting, and I know you've talked about this before, was Russell Kirk.
Oh, geez, yeah. Now, Russell Kirk wrote the book The Conservative Mind. That was published in 1953, and it's gone through I don't know how many editions, maybe anywhere from 7 to 9 editions, and it's been considered one of the key works in the conservative canon in America. And of course, he wrote many books. He was like the honorary founder of American conservatism, and he was exceptionally opposed to the Persian Gulf War. He told Lew Rockwell that he thought George H.W. Bush should be strung up on the White House lawn for war crimes. And he said, this is a guy who'd been very critical of libertarians and critical specifically of Murray Rothbard. Toward the end of his life in the 1990s, he said, well, I got to hand it to the libertarians. They really, really get foreign policy. How about that?
Interesting. That really is interesting. I mean, it's because I remember reading a couple of these pieces this one particular that Murray Rothbard responded to. But there was this Bill Buckley piece where he was basically saying more or less that, he kind of starts off in the first paragraph and he's like, yeah, well, you know, the great struggle in humanity is, tyranny versus liberty, and the state is the great evil, and there's no question about that. So it's kind of like, yeah, you guys are right. However, there's this thing that is the communist threat. And so we got to, we have to temporarily suspend our beliefs to build up this big military to go make sure that we defeat the Soviets.
He said we need a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores.
Yes.
I mean, he was very blunt about it.
Yeah. And I read Murray Rothbard just expertly responded to this thing. It's just, if you've never read Murray Rothbard, man, it's just a thing of beauty, but he just tore it apart. I remember him saying like, because of the threat of a totalitarian bureaucracy taking over, we better just create one here. It's interesting. It's like Russia was the excuse for why we'd have this big military and we'd always be fighting these wars. And then the Soviet Union collapses. And like a couple years later, it's like, well, Saddam's taking Kuwait.
Right. Yeah. These people cannot take yes for an answer. That's what they don't want. They don't want the enemy to go away. It is so, you think to yourself, there must be something wrong in my analysis. They can't possibly think this way. I must be attributing motives to them that they don't really have. But No, I don't think so. There's just no stopping these people. There's always some threat. The world is still a dangerous place was the most common refrain coming. The world is still a dangerous place. Yeah, partly because of you. You won't just let well enough alone.
Yeah. And this is, of course, now the official position of the State Department is that we're still pushing for regime change in Syria. And I mean, it's like, it seems to me like even the honest, almost all the honest conservatives, even the ones who were supporting the war. I mean, you look at someone like Tucker Carlson, who was a big proponent of the war in Iraq. But I mean, after a while, I mean, how could you not look at the track record of these military interventions of regime change and actually say and actually think to yourself, yeah, it would be a really good idea to get rid of a secular dictator in Syria?
I know. I mean, they just keep doing it. And then they say, when we try to tell them, well, you know, what did you think would happen? They say, well, who could have predicted that? Well, how about every single person who opposed you from the start? Who could have predicted that? By the way, you can just roll the dice and assume Ron Paul predicted it. I mean, you're going to be right more than wrong.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
No, absolutely. And of course, I mean, let's hold up Ron Paul's predictions to all of the neocon predictions about the war in Iraq. We'd be greeted as liberators and the war would be paid for in oil. And of course, democracy would then spread throughout the region.
Yeah. And then the idea that there might be internal infighting within the country. I don't see any evidence of that at all, says Bill Kristol.
Right.
It's just unbelievable. And I mean, everything who was it? Was it Bill Kristol? I forget which one of them wrote. Was it Dick Morris? I can't remember. But one of them wrote a book called Condi versus Hillary, the great 2012 matchup. Okay, well, neither one of those people, or maybe it was 2008, neither one of those people was anywhere near it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just keep doing this, and yet they keep getting invited on TV. I don't get it. Wouldn't you think after a while it would be embarrassing to have Bill Kristol on the show?
Yeah, you would think so, but somehow they still keep getting invited back.
But it makes it fun on Twitter. Every time Kristol appears to be predicting something, I reply by saying, well, we can all breathe a sigh of relief that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, right. No, absolutely. I mean, I do give Tucker Carlson a lot of credit because, I mean, he's had some interviews with some of these guys where he's really torn them up. I think there are people like Tucker who are at least, we wouldn't agree with him on everything, but he certainly is genuine in caring about America. And forget that. Even if you have no empathy for the people who were slaughtering or who the government is slaughtering over there, you know, just from an American perspective, this is gonna destroy us.
And incidentally, you mentioned Tucker Carlson. I mean, I think he's also a great interviewer. He does really, really well on that show of his. But given that we're mentioning Bill Kristol, we might as well note that the two of them are in a huge feud.
Yeah, they are.
And Kristol is calling Carlson all kinds of things, like I don't know if he called him a white nationalist, but certainly he's a believer in identity politics. He's basically trying to lump him in with the alt-right. It's just crazy hysteria from Kristol.
Which, of course, Tucker is, you know, he's pretty, I think he's pretty critical of open borders or mass immigration into the country. But, I mean, he's as anti-identity politics as you could be.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's going to, unless you're completely tone deaf, you know a priori that nobody who favors hard identity politics is going to have a major television show on any network, especially Fox News.
Yeah. No, well, of course, unless you're on the left. In which
then you could have Al Sharpton's program or whatever, but you're not going to have Tucker Carlson leading the white nationalists. There's that just, again, yeah. You would have to be completely tone deaf and not understand how American society works at all.
Yeah. All right. So that's decent transition, because I did want to ask you a little bit about immigration. And I'll say this is really probably the issue that I've had the toughest time kind of figuring out exactly where I stand on. And I got to say, I started from a, you know, kind of the somewhat, I think, naive open borders position, where it was just kind of like, well, we're against acts of aggression, so, you know, people have the right to travel, and that's, and I, it's not that I still don't in my heart of hearts believe that. I mean, what we really believe in is private borders, and that would solve all of these problems. But, and I was kind of, to be honest, I was a little saddened to see that this became the central issue of the Republican presidential campaign. I was really hoping after everything Ron Paul had done that maybe, like, you know, the wars or the Fed or at least government spending or something like this would be what dominates. And I'm still very, very turned off by the idea of building a wall. I am absolutely against any type of deportation force because I just do not trust the government to give them that type of power. That being said, though, I've come to see, I mean, in a few different ways. Like, one, practically, I think there's some real problems with immigration where the Democrats are clearly where they're losing, where they're not convincing the country on their ideas, so they're trying to import new voters for themselves. I see a real danger in Texas's demographic shifting and going blue, and then basically Republicans can't win national elections anymore. And because as you said earlier, we do work off principles, not just off what's effective. I do realize that when you see all these people coming out and supporting Trump and caring so much about this immigration issue, that is some information to the libertarian that a lot of these people, if they were allowed to make decisions about their private property, would not be deciding to have the current immigration policy that we have. So how do you... You know, where do you stand on immigration, and especially given that it seems to be like the biggest issue to the Republican base? We can't just not talk about it or not have a position on it. So how do you feel?
Yeah, it's hard because if you really want to get into the weeds of libertarian theory about immigration, there's no quick bumper sticker answer because, you know, you have to talk about all kinds of things like Rothbard and Hoppe talked about, and you can't fit that on a bumper sticker. You can't make a slogan out of it. So that makes it hard. So to some extent, you can read like articles by Hoppe about what is the real status of publicly owned property. Is it just, should we treat it as if it's unowned, or should we treat it as if it's owned more or less collectively by the taxpayers who fund it? And then you can start doing analysis from there. You could take the Jeff Deist route and say that in general, this, as with so many other things, we'd be a lot better off if we just decentralized the decision making. I mean, that's also Bob Murphy's opinion. Just instead of one central approach, get it down to the most local level possible, because then you're getting as close as you can conceivably get to what a private property society would look like and what the outcome would be there. Because it's certainly true that if people really were just making decisions about their own private property and the property of their own private communities, probably the demographic mix would not look the way it looks today. And these are things that once they're changed, can't be changed back, or very, very hard to change back. Yeah. So it's kind of like, I think the reason people are concerned about it is, and would say something like, well, we need to approximate what this policy would look like in the same way that with the public library. If the public library were owned by a private institution, probably, as Walter Block puts it, although Walter takes a different view on this from me, they would not allow smelly bums in the library cursing at the children. They just wouldn't allow it. But because it's a public library, do we therefore have to say, well, it's a public library, so, you know, liberty and everything, liberty of the hobo to go in there and shout? You don't have to. Why should you have to? I mean, it's bad enough they take your money to fund this thing. Then to add insult to injury, they're going to administer it in a way that offends everybody's sensibilities. Why would I have to endure that? And there is a genuine concern when you think about what were some of the arguments that Peter Bauer made about why foreign aid does not work. And some of the arguments had to do with culture. His point was, you can throw all the money you want to at a lot of different countries, but if the culture is anti-entrepreneurial, if the culture says the reason you exist is to enrich your relatives, that's why you're here, then entrepreneurship is dead in the water. Because as soon as you have a successful little shop, your relatives are going to want to know where their cut is. And then right. You can't reinvest the profits in the enterprise and you go under. But they would rather see you go under than have a shop where you're successful and they're left out. Well, how does that also translate into how government is administered? Enrich your relatives? Well, use your imagination. There are third world countries that are third world countries because they have this kind of mentality. And the concern is, if you were to import a lot of people whose mentality is that way, they don't magically stop thinking that way when they arrive here. And if you get to a point where you have more non-libertarians than the system can sustain, then maybe you never ever becomes completely out of reach to ever get it back. And so I understand the point is, well, the counter argument is, well, That may be, but libertarianism requires us to just sit back and let this happen. I can't imagine that's the case. That just sounds to me like libertarianism requires us to sit there and let the dirty, smelly bum, aggress against people in the library. It would be, well, look, it's too bad we have a public library, but in the interim, we're going to run that public library the way any rational person would think a private library would be run. And you may say, but we have so many millions of people. How would we ever come to one determination on how it would be run? Exactly. That's why you decentralize it as much as possible, to the point where eventually you just get down to private communities and then you have no more immigration problem.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And that obviously would be the best solution. And that's what we're aiming toward. But yeah, I mean, you just kind of like, it's like, given that there is, and this is, I forget exactly who put it this way. It might've been Molyneux, but someone said, it was like a thought experiment, which really kind of got me rethinking this a bit. Although it had been kind of like in steps that I had been reconsidering immigration, and I'm still not exactly sure exactly what I, because like you said, it's hard to fit on a bumper sticker. But they said, okay, well, let's say given that we do have the state as big as it is today, and the fact that people get to vote on who runs the thing. He goes, well, what if we said we have 10 million communists, card-carrying communists, who want to come into this country and start voting? Would you be for it or against it? And, you know, it's like almost no matter what your principles are on that issue, I think it's fairly reasonable for anybody to say, yeah, I would be against that because it's just right. Unwinnable.
Yeah. And of course, this is why Jefferson's view was that we don't want to encourage immigration from the old world because they're going to bring all their backward ideas on government with them. And why would we want to encourage that? And of course, the Free State Project is an example. What is the point of the Free State Project? To change the culture of New Hampshire, political culture, by importing people who think differently. Okay, well, right. So you see how that can happen, right? In the same way that they hope to make New Hampshire solidly libertarian, this approach will make every other place on earth solidly unlibertarian.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
I mean, that is something to think about. What is the point of the strategy of the Free State Project, if not precisely political change through demographic change?
Right. No, that's right. Absolutely right. And it's there's definitely a reason why the Democrats, who are so gung-ho on this policy, also say everyone who criticizes it is a Nazi.
Yeah. And I wonder what kids, the average kid these days, actually thinks the Nazis were all about. They probably think the Nazis were basically regular people who just didn't like immigration and they flew funny flags. I mean, they almost certainly do not realize the scope of the wickedness of National Socialism. Because if you're going to compare regular people to Nazis, right, what are people going to think?
Well, I think there's something, it's like after you spend a decade calling every person a racist, racist just doesn't have the same
right,
bite anymore.
Right, which is
anymore.
Precisely why they had to start using white supremacist.
Yep, that's right.
I just saw a big tweet that was heavily retweeted the other day, basically saying that the New York Times has become white supremacist. The New York Times has become white supremacist. And now, by the way, one counter argument you might make, or at least a cautionary note would be, look at what white people voting got America. Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson. I mean, these are pretty bad. I mean, could immigrants do worse than that? I don't know. So there is that too. I mean, it's not like saying, well, therefore let's roll the dice and see what happens. But I at the same time, I don't want to be a Pollyanna who thinks that, the so-called original American stock, boy, we can sure trust in them.
Yeah, no, you're
apparently not.
You're absolutely right. And this is what is so profoundly wrong about a particular sect of the alt-right, like the Richard Spencer wing of the alt-right, who's like, well, socialism is fine as long as it's socialism for white people. It's like, we've tried that, and it doesn't work out so well.
And that's a place where Hoppe's really great in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed. He has a whole chapter on libertarianism and conservatism. And he says that if you want to uphold all these good things that you say you cherish, whether it's family life or whatever, just traditional morality, you're undermining them with every single welfare state intervention you implement or every inflationary policy. Inflation under substantial inflation undermines thrift and undermines all the old-fashioned advice that older generations are trying to pass down to the kids. You're screwing yourself if you do this.
Yeah, that book is really just a phenomenal book, Democracy, the God That Failed. It's like each chapter in that book is a phenomenal book on its own. And then it's just unbelievable. But yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think that more and more people are realizing that to some degree. And just simply out of the fact that the lefties have taken so much control of the government, of Hollywood, of the, you know, the universities, that it's like, I think more and more conservatives are starting to realize that, oh, maybe just not having this authority would be better.
Yeah, yeah. And the more people who start thinking that way, the better.
Yeah. So do you think, because I've heard Jeff Deist and, you know, Hans Hermann Hoppe kind of make the decentralism argument that this is kind of the best way to promote our ideas going forward, is just promoting, hey, let's just solve these at the local level. I know a mutual friend of ours who I met through the Tom Woods 1000th episode and the Contra Cruise, which is the most fun thing in the universe.
Michael Bolden,
who is also a big believer in that. And like, I'm, again, not that these things are one or the other. I mean, I guess we can do all. But I still, and maybe this is just, you know, that I can't give up on this Ron Paul thing, which I get teased about at times, that, you know, it's like I'm still living in 2012. But I do just look at like what a at least what felt like a pretty big movement that we had going there. And like, maybe we can kind of get a big movement going, all, you know, based off the ideas of liberty, that we can kind of find a message that's that appeals to, you know, large groups of people, diverse groups of people. I mean, look, I'm not being like naive about who Ron Paul was appealing to. I'm not saying it was like wildly popular in the inner cities, but it certainly wasn't an exclusionary group at all. It was pretty diverse as far as Republican movements go. And I still, I don't know, I kind of feel like in some way, like, oh, we should be aiming to some degree to get like a libertarian leader like that to use politics just as like a bully pulpit.
Yeah, I know. It's just that every name that's proposed as being somebody who could be like the next Ron Paul, they might be fine fellows in one way or another, but they don't exude that simplicity, in the sense that, not that he wasn't smart, he was, but I mean, the lack of guile.
Yeah.
That when you look at him, you are seeing right into his soul. Like, that the man you see on that TV screen is the man you're going to meet in person, and who is sincere, who's absolutely unafraid to answer any question under the sun, and is just as pure as the driven snow in his personal life. These are tough expectations to live up to, I think. So I agree. I want that more than anything. Just the other day, I was looking back at a video from 2008, because, you know, people made these great Ron Paul clip compilation videos that you and I used to watch and get really inspired by, and there'd be great music in the background. It would just be awesome. And there was one that I liked a lot. Didn't get that many views, but I really liked. And I was just watching it the other day, and it just filled me with so much hope, but then despair, because I thought, are these days over forever? Because at that time, I thought, you know, this is going to end at some point, but I can't think that far ahead. I got to enjoy it while it's going on, because every day was great. You get up and turn on YouTube and see what has happened with Ron Paul. What interview did he give where he blew somebody's mind, or what rally speech did he give, or what was the size of his crowd yesterday?
Yeah.
And you could check in on all that, and you knew it was going to be great. And then when he was running again for 2012, you thought, oh, man, now we're going to start off with a 10% base.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing. And then to not have it anymore is just, it's a real bummer. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree with you. And I know it's kind of like fashionable amongst libertarians. I know me and you have talked about this, and you and Malice talked about it on your podcast a bit. But I get that it's very fashionable to just say like, well, I'm not even going to participate in the political system because, you know, I'd rather, you know, the state is coercion, so we'll just go over here and live our lives. But it's like, I don't know, what else besides Ron Paul getting up there and telling the truth ever gave us that?
That's the thing. That's the best argument for politics there is precisely that. But yet the argument against politics is, how many Ron Pauls have we ever gotten?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe in sitting around hoping for another one, maybe there's something else we should be doing. I don't really know. Just keep fighting in your own way, and we'll just see what happens. I don't know what else to do. I mean, if there is another Ron Paul, I'll be the first to sign up. But I'm very, very frustrated to have to be skeptical.
So all we need is a guy who's like a really
don't
great
even
human being.
Think about.
No, I wasn't saying you. I wasn't even saying that. That's not where I was going. But you know, since you put it out there.
But by the way, but let me just jump in so people don't think I have a huge ego and I'm full of myself. You were talking to me about this on the Contra Cruise. It was not just, why he must mean me. I don't want people to think that.
Yes, I was relentlessly pushing you in that direction. But I understand that's not going to happen. Tom's got like 72 daughters or something like that.
I got to count again, but it's somewhere in the area of 72.
It's something really biblical that, like, you know, you wouldn't even think is possible. I was saying it is kind of sad, but with Ron Paul, you got to find a guy who's like pure as snow, as you were saying, who's like a medical doctor who knows more about economics and foreign policy than every economics and foreign policy expert in the world. It's not easy.
Yeah, I totally agreed. I know. So that's our trouble right now.
All right. Well, you know, we will indeed, I guess, see what happens. What do you think? Maybe just to close out here, we'll just talk a little bit of current events. So what do you think? Because I know, and I know a little bit because I regularly listen to your show. But man, I will say, and there is something, as I said before, one of the things that I didn't like about immigration becoming the animating issue of the Trump campaign was I just felt like, and maybe this is, I almost catch myself when I still sound like a lefty, which I hate to do, but there is something that bothered me that it's like, I much more liked the idea of the Ron Paul campaign where it's like, hey, blame the problems in the economy on government spending, these trillions we've wasted on wars, the Federal Reserve causing the boom bust. And it just seems a little, you know, oh no, the problem is the Mexicans and the problem is that we don't, you know, China is manipulating their currency. It's like, this is just, to me, you're not really getting at the center of the issue. And I had a lot of problems with Trump and I still do. I think he's in many ways been a failure as a president. And I think he's doing a lot of bad stuff, namely on foreign policy. But it's like, I'm in this position and I think you are too, where the anti-Trump hysteria is just so ridiculously stupid that it's hard to focus on anything else.
Yeah. I totally agree. I totally agree. And let me just say, we have this podcast called Contra Krugman.
Oh yeah.
That Bob Murphy and I do. And we've spent, well, obviously we spend every episode going after Paul Krugman, but we wind up, also sometimes having to look like we're defending Trump on these episodes because we have so much hysteria out there about Trump, let's say, being, because to me, this is the key thing right now in the news or talking with the left or talking with your friends. It's everybody's hysterical about Trump now. And whereas, you know, under with Ron Paul running, okay, some people didn't like Obama. I get that. But these days, it's like Trump is the worst president we've ever had. And it's because of this thing that he does. And so Bob and I have to keep pointing out, look, we're not saying Trump's the greatest president of all time. But for goodness sake, I mean, Bill Clinton bombed Serbia right at the time that Congress voted not to authorize it. I mean, they voted, actively voted to not authorize it. And he went ahead and did it. Now, imagine if Trump did that, people would be dying. Yeah. They would be going berserk about this. So for me right now, the thing that I don't really want to be dealing with, but I feel like I wind up having to do it, is that because of the stupid hysteria about Trump, which, as I say, to me is like the key issue right now, I can think of 25 good reasons to be anti-Trump and concerned about Trump. But to say that Trump is bad because of the following three trivial things – when his predecessors did much worse things in that regard. I mean, Ellen DeGeneres is posing happily with George W. Bush the other day and stuff. What is wrong with you? I mean, Trump has his problems and he's bombing too much and it's awful and he's given the military-industrial complex everything they asked for. But that's not what they criticize him for. That's the only thing they praise.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
so
right.
Anyway, that's where my mind is right now is this whole, I'm afraid that the hysteria about Trump is going to make us forget how bad his predecessors were and lull us into this belief that the problem is one person.
Yeah.
That we got to get rid of the one person. And I was just quoting this on my show the other day, but I saw this meme where it was saying that something like a democracy or statism is the idea that that you have a car like a car that's totaled, and the way you fix it is you change the driver. You know, and likewise here. I mean, I we could get Trump out and put somebody else in, and there'd be other outrages.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And the thing you hit on there that I think is really the most important, or equally important, to the fact that the outrage kind of gives a pass to everything that came before him. But the real thing is that it's like, yeah, okay, so Trump is doing some really bad stuff, but they're not actually angry about that. If anything, that's the part that they're completely fine with. It's like the truth is that we have Trump is untying the hands of the military, as he said, basically, you know, killing more people. He's continuing these horrible wars, even though he promised he wouldn't. And government spending under a completely Republican-controlled Congress and executive branch is going to go up. But this isn't the thing that any of the anti-Trump people care about at all. It's like, oh, my God, he allegedly called Haiti a shithole in a private meeting.
Yeah, it's crazy. And as people were saying, you could bomb Haiti and they wouldn't even care.
Yeah.
Or they'd care a little, but calling them a name is so much worse. It's insane. But also, Glenn Greenwald has been trying to say, look, you just handed Trump more surveillance powers. Why is that? Why are you not worried about that? Like, why are you saying Trump is Hitler, but that, you know, it's okay for the Democrats to support giving him more surveillance power? And I read that thread on Twitter, and you got some of Greenwald's readers saying, well, we just don't think surveillance is as important as you think it is, because we think DACA is important, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, go ahead, spy on me, blackmail me, ruin my life, have the risk of that happening.
Right.
And, you know, just so I can get what I want in other areas.
Yeah,
as
long as my feelings aren't hurt by it, then building the biggest spying apparatus in the history of mankind is okay.
I love when people like Glenn Greenwald blast these people to smithereens. Couldn't happen to a more deserving bunch.
Yeah, no, I agree. Glenn Greenwald's done some good work, no question about it. And he was somebody who certainly was, you know, not a supporter, but was kind to the Ron Paul campaigns. And he's one of the journalists out there who's really done some work exposing some real high level corruption in government. And, you know, I remember feeling like for a little while, like during the Ron Paul days, that you know, I had kind of figured out how the system works. Democrats and Republicans were essentially the same. And like in some cases that's still true. I mean, when you were talking before about who was saying, you know, Hillary Clinton versus Condoleezza Rice. I mean, like, find me the difference between those two. They're like exactly the same, pretty much. Like,
yeah, that's exactly the kind of race the New York Times would love.
Right. I mean, it's like there's, you know, you can exaggerate the tiny little differences, but basically they're exactly the same. But man, I mean, as of late, this thing has, you know, become pretty unpredictable and pretty interesting, if not, you know, kind of in a tragic way. But yeah. Everything about the Trump campaign was very unpredictable and very, you know, entertaining, if nothing else. But I gotta say, I'm really quite surprised with the way this Mueller special investigation has been working out. And I never would have imagined that this special investigation might end up taking down the Democrats. But it looks like that might be the case. I mean, you remember everyone in the news was just making fun of Trump for believing that he was being spied on. And now it seems to be coming out as almost a certainty.
And now they've just voted, the House House Intel has voted to release the FISA memo to the public, which was the one that Adam Schiff was saying, well, we can't release it because the American people won't understand it. He was the key Democrat on the committee.
Right.
And so that's funny, first of all, that you're reduced to making an argument like that. So that's gonna be interesting. That news just broke, I think, not too long ago, like within just this afternoon.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's funny the way that whole thing's turning out. But geez, the thing is, we don't know the half of what goes on really in this government. The half of the secret stuff that goes on. I mean, the stuff that we do know about is bad enough, So imagine, you know, I sometimes, when I look in the eyes of George H.W. Bush on TV, I mean, this guy, I mean, he did it all. You know, he was in the CIA. He's been vice president, president. He's been at the UN. He's been all around Congress. He's been everywhere. But he knows, if he knows everything. He knows everything that's going on and where it's going on and what's happening. And I just wonder, I don't know, I mean, what kind of soul that guy has or what kind of burdens he walks around with. I just wonder because he knows, that guy knows a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's like we, you don't want to foolishly like speculate or jump to conclusions that you know, you don't have like substantial evidence for. But at the same time, it would be ignorant to not, you know, acknowledge that if we know about all of these atrocities and there's so much secrecy in government, I mean, it stands to reason that they would try to cover up the worst of it. And we know that this shadow government acts, you know, in complete secrecy. And look, I mean, I think one of the things that human beings, it's kind of one of the things that holds us back in a way, but people who are not predatory sociopaths tend to project onto others the idea that, well, nobody's just like a predatory sociopath. But, you know, I mean, you know this both as a Christian and also because you study this stuff very deeply. There is real evil in the world. And I know you've talked about the clip before. I've played it a bunch of times on the show where Madeleine Albright is presented with the UN study that says 500,000 children died from starvation under the Clinton blockade of Iraq. And she doesn't even hesitate. It's like, well, we believe that price is worth it. It's like, what kind of person can react that way?
Yeah, and what kind of person can respond to that by saying, well, that UN figure is inflated? But that's not even remotely the point.
Yeah, okay.
I don't care if the UN figure is inflated. She took it at face value and said that was worth it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what matters.
Whatever. Let's say it's inflated by 75%. I mean, yeah, whatever. Yeah, right, you know, exactly. Like, okay, so fine. You know, it like, yeah, but who are these people? And the more and more, I think one of the only silver linings for me that's really come out of the last couple of years in politics is that it does seem that it's getting harder and harder for the government to keep secrets. And slowly, I think people are more and more catching on to the fact that there's some real bad people that do not have our best interests in mind.
Yeah, that's no question about it. And the thing is that when we find it, when things do trickle out, like Operation Northwoods.
Yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me? This thing, they were planning, and Kennedy was against it, thank goodness. They were planning false terror attacks in the U.S. that they could blame on Castro. I mean, that was a serious proposal. Or on a smaller scale, I mean, anybody listening could probably come up with a half dozen of these. But on a smaller scale, I found it very interesting that in the mid-1990s, we found out that, to some extent, modern art had been subsidized and supported by the CIA and used as a weapon. Like, so they basically, the idea was to make the Soviets feel like they were stupid and backward and falling behind in the arts, because they would pump up this kind of art like Jackson Pollock and say, this is what all the cool kids are doing now. I mean, who would have guessed the CIA was behind that?
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, maybe I'm just a Philistine, but I look at that stuff and I say, yeah, probably only the CIA would want any of this stuff, but that's just me. Sorry for all you art people out there.
No, but I mean, that is very interesting information.
Yeah, I mean, you like, know? If they're doing these things on, you know, if they're infiltrating their way into culture at that kind of a level in that one area, what other things could they be doing? Is it really plausible that we have found out everything they've been doing? Because if that's the case, they stink at it.
Right. And it seems highly unlikely. And then you do, you know, I wonder, and I try to not jump to conclusions with this stuff, especially when, like, as you've said, like, we've got so many of the atrocities right out in the open, so we can focus on those. But it is, you know, when you see, like, the way the entire mainstream media acts, I mean, what legitimate journalist, forget what you're what side you're on, who wouldn't want this memo released? Who wouldn't want the information if you're a journalist? And yet at least not too many of them seem to be very interested in it. And then, you know, you look at what's happened to the universities. It's like, well, wouldn't wouldn't, of course, they try to infiltrate these two institutions? I mean, wouldn't you? Come on. I mean, if you just put yourself in their shoes for a second, you're like, well, the colleges and the media, that's what we'd have to get into.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when you look at the house organs, let's say, of the regime, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, you know, they're adversarial in some ways. But one thing Noam Chomsky is good on is his analysis of the media and how it treats issues like war. And somebody, it might have been Chomsky, I don't remember, but somebody did a study back in 1990 when Operation Desert Shield was taking shape, when they were just sending the troops to Saudi Arabia, but there was no, or, you know, to the Middle East, but there was no war going on until the next 91. When you look at the editorial pages of the American newspapers, it was like every single one of them was for the war. Like there might have been three exceptions. It was some bizarre number. That just doesn't make sense. There really be no difference of opinion on this? Now, I'm not saying that therefore the CIA controls all the editorial boards, but what I am saying is something extremely weird is happening, because certainly that was not the way American opinion broke down on that war.
Right.
I mean, that's just bizarre. No one? There's nothing that's going to be said against this? Until afterward or years later or something. Although that war remained popular. The second Iraq war was less popular, but even then, by and large, the editorial writers were in favor of that war too.
Yeah, it does. It certainly does seem strange. And I got to say, what seems even just crazier to me is just how nutty. And I know you talk a bit about this, and well, I'll let you go after this. But you know how insane, because it's like beyond. It's a cartoon at this point. It's just utterly insane. The campus culture has become. And you do wonder about who, you know, not so much the kids, because, you know, okay, so you fill, you know, like some 20-year-old with some feeling of like righteous, you know, indignation or whatever, and you give them a bunch of propaganda. Okay, these are young people who are easily propagandized. That's why people always go after the youth. But it's like, who are the adults around who are like perpetuating this? And I know a lot of them aren't part of some conspiracy. They just kind of, you know, go along. But what do you know, I know you love to smack this stuff down. I do too, because it's so absurd. But what do you think, like, you know, are going to be the long-term effects of what has really, I mean, just gotten to complete madness in the universities?
Well, first of all, I think the universities are going to, more and more of them are going to be in financial trouble, and that's to the good. So some of them are just going to go under. And I think there will be more and more inexpensive online alternatives. And when you have online alternatives, yeah, you can have SJW stuff in there. But really, to be intimidated by these people, they need to be in your face. So I think it'll be more of a relief to be taking online courses. You'll always have the elite schools. Those aren't going away. Those rich parents want their kid to get that certification from the elite schools. But every other school is vulnerable to some degree. So we're definitely going to have that. But also, I think we should, and I say this as somebody who complains about the universities all the time, we should realize that most students who go to these schools really just want to keep their heads down and get out of there. I don't think most of them agree with the crazy lunatics. They just don't want to get hurt. And I think they keep their heads down and they get out of there. And I think there's a good chance of a backlash. I mean, remember when there's one of those times when that Triggly Puff was there, Milo went to speak, and that audience cheered like crazy every time somebody on stage talked about, we're sick and tired of being intimidated and told we can't listen to anybody we darn well please. The huge cheers overwhelmed the protesters. So, you know, maybe it's not as bad as we think, because it's so stupid that even the typical, you know, American student who doesn't really know a whole lot can see through it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And it seems to me like and this is, of course, when I was on your podcast, I believe it was my second appearance on your podcast, I talked about this a little bit, but I was saying, you know, this is like the left is overplaying their hand in a way that you couldn't even have imagined. And it's gotta be, I mean, I don't know that the majority of people there are reasonable, but like any intelligent, open-minded person who's looking at this has gotta start to notice, okay, this is kind of crazy. And you do see this. I mean, you know, you look at the numbers, like what Jordan Peterson is doing and what, you know, like just a lot of these guys online, obviously what you're doing. And it's like, okay, so maybe the bright side here is that this is going to really undermine the universities, and people who are looking for truth are going to start getting it in other places. And yeah, hopefully they all end up going and signing up for Liberty Classroom, and yeah, we can get them that way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I can't change these universities, but in the age of the internet, I can create my own thing.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's pretty much what I'm doing. And you know, in the comedy world, I mean, you have your own podcast, but Owen Benjamin, when he ran into trouble with the PC people, he can create his own career.
Yeah, that's
right. He can create it, you know, and spread the word and build up an audience through the internet. So on the one hand, it's a hard time to be alive because you got a lot of enemies who will say terrible, obviously false things about you. But on the other hand, you have an unprecedented opportunity to build up a tribe of your own who will defend you to the death, and it's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, I think you're absolutely right, and that's as good a place as any to leave things, because I could talk to you for 6 hours. But as I said, you have 73 children to raise. So
that's right.
I
forgot to say we had one during this conversation.
All right, Tom. Well, listen, I appreciate your work so much. I appreciate everything you do. Thank you so much. This is a great episode, and keep fighting the good fight, my friend.
Thanks a million, Dave. Glad to be here.
All right, everybody, that's today's episode. That was a long one, but I hope you felt like it was worth it. And what else do I have to tell you? Well, I've already kept you for about an hour and a half. I think I'll just let you go, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.